and thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Wild Virginia Virtual Coffee Talk. I'm your host, Katie Keller, Publicity and Outreach Director with Wild Virginia. And today we have Lauren Stockman on the line, who is the Research Director at Oil Change International. So today we're going to discuss some Mountain Valley Pipeline myths and bust those. Talk about some of the misconceptions behind the pipeline and some of the things that MVP and their allies are claiming. So they claim that the pipeline is nearly complete, ranging from 90 to 94%. But according to their own records, the pipeline is actually 56% complete. So I know that our members are really interested in hearing about some of these misconceptions behind pipeline infrastructure and a better way forward for Virginia, our future and in energy, and to make sure that both humans and wildlife are safe in the process. So Lauren, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, great to be here.
Wonderful. So first, let's start a little bit about yourself and your background and some of the work that you do at Oil Change International.
Yeah, sure. So I've been working for over 20 years with NGOs in the environmental and social justice space, you know, focused on climate and energy issues. And for the past 11 years, I've been with Oil Change International, which is a research, communications and advocacy group focused on climate and energy. With Oil Change, I've been, you know, primarily focused on North American oil and gas from the tar sands in Canada, Keystone XL pipeline, et cetera, to the U.S. fracking boom. And, you know, our focus has been really to expose the climate risk of this kind of relentless oil and gas production growth that's been going on in North America and the impact of infrastructure like pipelines and export terminals on greenhouse gas emissions. So Oil Change has really been at the forefront of the call to account for the emissions impact of new oil and gas infrastructure.
That's great. And you have such a bird's eye view thinking about all of these different types of infrastructures in place across the continent. So let's talk about some of the general misconceptions about pipelines that you've heard from the public's view and which ones industry tries to perpetuate.
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, there are many myths peddled by industry and regulators about the benefits of pipelines and the, you know, downplaying the costs. But, you know, the myths that we have focused on have been primarily about the perceived need for a new pipeline and the idea that emissions caused by burning the oil or the gas delivered by a new pipeline will happen whether the pipeline is built or not. So, you know, we've seen in sort of environmental impact studies done by regulators like the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, you know, where they would calculate the greenhouse gases produced by the pipeline, but then they would say, you know, there's no significant impact because this gas would get to market anyway, it would be burned anyway in some way. So it's really, you know, those two pieces that we've really focused on the kind of, you know, the need, the market need for a pipeline. This is really a fundamental issue because when it comes to, you know, particularly interstate gas pipelines, the key criteria for regulatory approval is something called a certificate of public convenience and necessity. If companies convince FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, that a pipeline is necessary to provide energy, then everything they need generally follows from that, right? Taking land by eminent domain, acquiring other environmental permits, either at the federal or state level, those are all kind of predicated on this finding by FERC that the pipeline is in the public interest, is a necessary piece of infrastructure. We've questioned the analysis of need on a number of levels, and you know, primarily from a climate lens. We use what climate science tells us about the limits of our climate system to absorb greenhouse gases, and have demonstrated, you know, the imperative to drastically reduce our consumption of all fossil fuels, not just coal, but gas too. And that has to happen within the lifetime of this proposed infrastructure. So we basically show that we simply, you know, we don't have the emissions budget or carbon budget left to operate these pipelines for the next 20, 30, 40 years, you know, of their economic lifetime. And then, you know, in addition, we've argued that the market analysis done by companies and government agencies that says that, you know, gas pipelines are the only way to phase out coal. This has, you know, been used a lot, particularly with MVP and ACP in terms of, you know, the amount of coal power that's still operating in the southeast. And we've basically shown that idea that, you know, only gas can compete with coal-fired power is fundamentally flawed. Solar energy has for years now been shown to be cheaper on a full cost of building and operating, you know, utility scale solar plants compared to coal or gas power plants. Solar farms have been shown to you know, produce electricity at a lower cost for the, you know, and this has been the case since about 2016, 2017. It may not have been the case when MVP was first proposed, but we said then that the cost of renewable energy would fall while the cost of gas will rise over the lifetime of these projects. And so, you know, locking in gas as a source of electricity generation for decades to come was a bad deal for consumers as well as the climate. And that's exactly what has happened, right? Solar is now the cheapest source of electricity generation in the southeast, and its cost is expected to keep falling. And the same can be said for battery storage, for wind. And, you know, the most exciting energy opportunity for the southeast today is offshore wind. All of this has been happening in the time frame of what would have been the first few years of MVP's operation had it stayed on schedule. So, you know, we were saying if you look at the future of renewable energy rather than the present, it's clear new pipelines are not needed. And we were right.
Sure. And it seems to make sense. I'm unsure of where the disconnect is if we are seeing in these analyses that the cost is falling for renewable energy. I'm still unsure of why we're able to see these new proposed pipelines come through. And, you know, speaking to an eminent domain, I know that was a huge issue for the Atlantic Coast Pipeline and a lot of the landowners that we were working with. Mm. And it just kind of goes to show that fossil fuel companies are really notorious for spreading lies about their projects and climate change. Because I know that the public and the people know that climate change is real and fossil fuel projects shouldn't be the future. So it's just all really interesting to me how these projects are still able to be pushed through.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's, you know, it's clear to most people that kind of, you know, the cozy relationship that regulators have had with companies. And also, you know, I mean, I think we've seen with ACP in particular, but MVP as well, you know, that the regulatory requirement to show public need was simply that they had contracts in place to buy the gas. And, you know, easily demonstrated with ACP in particular, that the only companies that had signed contracts with the pipeline company were, in fact, the owners of the pipeline, right? It was their opinion.
Well, and hopefully, you know, we're heading in that direction, similar to ACP. I was so excited when I heard that news.
Yeah.
Hopefully the same will be for MVP. But speaking of, you know, cozy relationships, how about misleading stories from politicians on the need for new pipelines? If you could speak to that.
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, I think the most important one and most recent one today is, you know, Senator Joe Manchin's recent statement that MVP is of national strategic importance and that it will somehow help the U.S. support Europe in its efforts to move away from Russian gas. And, you know, this is false on so many levels. First, Europe's prime response to the energy crunch that's been triggered by the war is to accelerate its transition away from fossil fuels. It's raised its targets of renewable energy generation. It's brought forward dates for achieving these targets. And while it is looking for gas supplies to replace Russian gas in the short term, it has actually made clear that it's not looking for long-term commitment to more gas. And this is, you know, in recognition of the need to reduce gas to achieve climate goals as well as for its energy security goals. And then, you know, there's the fact of you know, what would MVP's role be in supplying gas to Europe? And I think Manchin is kind of overlooking a lot of things here. you know, if Europe was ready to commit to additional US gas in the long term, MVP doesn't really do much to enhance the availability of gas for export to Europe. Although MVP, you know, it could be connected to pipeline networks that could feed LNG export terminals on the Gulf Coast. These export facilities are not constrained by the availability of gas. They have, you know, plenty of gas in their backyard in Texas and Louisiana, and that, and sourcing gas from there would be much more economical for them. The fact is that the current constraint on exporting more gas to Europe is the capacity to actually liquefy that gas and load it onto tankers. I.e., you know, the LNG terminals on the Gulf Coast are already maxed out. And expanding that capacity, building new terminals or expanding the existing ones, it will take several years. These are huge pieces of infrastructure that take years to build. And by that time, it's unclear if the need will still be there, given the focus on decarbonization in Europe. So that's why, you know, we're not seeing investment kind of rush in, and we're not seeing European companies rush to sign long-term contracts for new LNG capacity. I think Manchin needs to kind of let go of this idea of, whatever energy crisis pops up in any part of the country or the world, MVP is the solution. It's not the solution to the Southeast coal power problem, and it's not the solution to Europe's energy crisis. It was a bad idea to begin with, and it's still a bad idea. And the solution to all of these things is clean, renewable energy that's not based on globally traded fuel supplies.
Right. Well, renewable energy, we've seen it successful in other countries. And I feel like, you know, saying that MVP is the solution to things, the situation is a little more complicated. And so looking at it from a bird's eye view and, you know, thinking about all of the different energy sources, that seems silly that would be the narrative that he's kind of pushing. So, you know, politicians, fossil fuel companies, obviously we are, you know, busting these pipeline myths, but they have been in a position where this kind of infrastructure is what they've been pushing. So, you know, thanks for touching on that. So let's talk about moving in the right direction to more sustainable sources over coal. Like I said, we've seen it successful in other countries. So what are your thoughts there?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we have seen tremendous progress in the development of renewable energy in the US and globally. We have a long way to go, but we're really starting to kind of reach a tipping point. And Department of Energy's Energy Information Administration produced a report just last month projecting that in the next couple of years, this year and into 23 and 24, we're actually going to see coal and gas plants in the US produce less electricity and renewable energy start to displace that coal and gas simply because it's cheaper to run these plants, utility scale wind and solar plants, than it is to run the coal and gas plants. So they actually came out with this analysis saying, you know, renewable energy in the US is going to start displacing gas generation in the same way that gas generation has displaced coal in the last 10 years. So we're seeing kind of a tipping point where renewable energy is actually, you know, causing us to use less coal and less gas in the electricity generation area. We're also going to see in the next few years tremendous progress in energy storage. We're seeing new types of energy storage come into the market. We're seeing the costs falling on the established kind of lithium ion battery storage. So we're going to see tremendous growth in that. And we're also going to see an offshore wind industry emerge, particularly along the eastern seaboard, which is going to create thousands of jobs and add a source of renewable energy that has tremendous potential for providing enormous quantities of clean energy. The fact is the US is actually 20 years behind Europe in offshore wind, 20 years in which the US has, you know, primarily pursued fracking and all the destruction and pollution that caused. So we're making up for lost time. And, you know, we are seeing an emerging offshore wind industry coming to the US, which is, you know, which is going to really kind of up our game in terms of the amount of renewable energy we can introduce into the system. The Northeast is, you know, has set really ambitious targets for this. Virginia and the Carolinas, you know, not so ambitious, and we really need to kind of see them step up and focus on that area, which I think, you know, is really going to, you know, help us move away from the coal and gas that has been the focus of the recent decades.
Definitely need to step up to reach, you know, make up for lost time, like you said, to reach those climate goals. So one thing that I've really liked seeing in the headlines as of recent with the current administration is that, you know, the climate crisis is a national security issue. So let's talk about sort of current events and U.S. oil and gas companies and sort of the narrative that they've been pushing, the implications of finance that we've seen today, you know, with the war in Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, I think the war, you know, has added impetus on certain levels. It's made it clearer than ever that we need to end our reliance on fossil fuels, and that, you know, climate action and energy security are one in the same. You know, of course, the industry is saying the opposite and saying, you know, now's the time to step up more investment in oil and gas, and particularly in LNG export capacity. But you know, we have seen some pushback on that from the Biden administration, and certainly, you know, the debate is in Europe as well as here in the US is certainly very live around you know, how to respond to this, and that response being, you know, more about getting off of fossil fuels rather than increasing them. But, you know, I think you know, in terms of finance, I mean, you know, we're certainly seeing, you know, in terms of the banks, they're still very, you know, they're still financing a lot of oil and gas infrastructure. You know, the focus is moving a little bit more to Asia and sort of, you know, building out LNG import capacity in Asia. But even that's starting to become questioned now as, you know, the vulnerability of the global trade in gas has been exposed by the war. But I think, you know, the other piece that people, you know, are maybe less aware of is, you know, the fact that governments right now seem to be missing an opportunity to grab a share of the windfall that oil and gas companies are enjoying and use that money to relieve energy poverty for the most vulnerable, but also invest in accelerating the transition. We published a report in March that showed that companies extracting oil and gas from the ground in the US alone can expect $126 billion windfall in 2022, simply because the price of oil and gas has spiked as a result of the invasion of Ukraine. And, you know, also because the US tax regime, I'm not talking about corporate tax here, but the royalties and taxes that are placed upon oil and gas extraction, those favor company profits over the public good. So as the price of oil and gas rises, companies get to keep that windfall rather than the government getting a larger share. So it's a regressive tax policy, right? And, you know, we've been calling on Congress to, you know, pass a windfall tax on this 2022 windfall and use that money to, you know, alleviate energy poverty for those most in need, but also, you know, put that money towards accelerating the transition that we need to see in order to become, you know, both climate resilient and energy secure. So, you know, again, we're kind of, you know, we're in this almost at a tipping point where, you know, these technologies are making a lot of ground, are really, you know, proving themselves able to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. But, you know, as a result of the war, the fossil fuel companies are actually making record profits. And, you know, I think what could really kind of change the game is if the government actually stepped in and took some of that money rather than it going back to, you know, shareholders and paying big bonuses to executives, or being reinvested in more production, which is, you know, not what we need, that money could be supporting a faster transition to clean energy.
Sure. Well, we'll be sure to link to that report that Oil Change published in March. So while Virginia is all about mobilizing citizens and, you know, getting them involved in the fight, so what's next for U.S. states to help better meet all of these climate goals? And what can pipeline fighters and other advocates do?
Yeah, good question. You know, I think what pipeline fighters in Virginia and North Carolina have done is absolutely remarkable. They've gone after every permit. They've shown up at every hearing and left no stone unturned. And, it's amazing what's been achieved, in this area. Obviously, we need to keep that up to finally kill MVP. Beyond that, we need to keep pushing the states to set more ambitious targets for clean energy and reducing fossil fuel use. This transition requires a stable policy environment. We need clear short, medium, and long-term goals. That's what creates the stability for investment to flow in to clean energy, to create jobs and make the change happen. I think that, you know, the southeastern states can be a lot more aggressive on offshore wind, for example. As I mentioned earlier, you know, northeastern states have set really ambitious targets, calling for tens of gigawatts of offshore wind capacity. The targets in Virginia and the Carolinas are much lower, and as a result, you see less investment. We just saw the federal government pull in $4.3 billion for offshore wind leases off of New York. You know, because the nearby states, New York, New Jersey, etc., have set big targets for using that wind energy. This week, we'll see a sale off of the Carolinas, which will be much smaller. And I think, you know, that's partly because the states have just not set these clear targets that provide certainty for investors. So I think, you know, the Southeast needs to raise its ambition. We need to put the pressure on them to do that. And we need to, you know, they need to tell the big utilities like Duke and Dominion what they want to see, rather than the other way around.
Sure, we can continue to stop these pipeline projects, but we do need to have policy or targets in place that helps to shape the future in the direction of clean energy, offshore wind, solar, the et cetera, et cetera. Well, Lauren, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate your insights, and we'll link to all the information that our audience can, you know, peruse to learn more or get involved. In the meantime, everyone should follow Oil Change International, a ton of information on pipelines across the continent that can be helpful if you want to learn more or get involved. But as always, for more on pipeline updates here on the ground in Virginia on MVP, visit www.wildvirginia.org.